A family moves into an old abandoned house with a dark past. They find a weathered antique in the attic or the basement, and it carries a horrible curse. Maybe it's a creepy doll that always seems to be watching. Or maybe the house was built on an ancient Indian burial ground. But soon, that family is killed off, one by one. The slashier, the better. Until there is just one left. The final girl that escapes with her life. Barely. Sound familiar? Yep, we love to curl up on a dark night, popcorn bowl in hand and our fuzzy blanket to hide behind, to watch or read our favorite horror, especially at this time of year, Halloween. So let's face the scary truth. The horror genre is full of old age tropes and same old storylines, especially when it comes to indigenous representation. Spoiler alert, we do not make it to the end. Sometimes, not even the beginning. But thanks to a new generation of indigenous storytellers, the horror genre is again rising from the grave. Anin, Buju, hello, and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Shane Hawk is a self-described scaredy cat, but he says there's nothing like a terrifying story to bring people together.
A lot of Indigenous folks like to hear creepy stories because it's a way to connect.
And poetry can be pretty horrifying. Tiffany Morris uses horror poetry to face her own monster, anxiety around climate disaster.
Horror is a space that deals with urgency and the inability to refuse what's in front of you.
Plus, Dr. Kaylee Simmons finds horror movie portrayals of Indigenous people dead. But she says new Indigenous stories pull real fear from deeper places.
That's what's exciting about all this new stuff, is that it's like showing a depth to Indigenous existence that I think horror has largely failed to do so.
Today, scary storytellers are here to freak you out and to reveal the important truths that can only be told in the dark. Kaylee Simmons loves a terrifying movie, but she never saw the Indigenous point of view in horror movies until she watched Rhymes for Young Ghouls.
The day I found my mother dead.
Don't look, Tush! Don't look!
I aged by 1,000 years.
Rhymes for Young Ghouls is a 2013 film from the late Mi'kmaq writer and director Jeff Barnaby. Kaylee was struck by his powerful female protagonist.
Don't act like a badass if you can't fight.
And the way that Barnaby used zombies in his film. More of a connection to the past than a craving for brains. The story piqued her interest about the many tropes of mainstream horror movies and how they tend to depict Indigenous people. Kaylee is an English professor at the University of Connecticut. She teaches and writes about Indigenous representation in horror and the ways Indigenous storymakers are breaking the stereotypes to create new, chilling alternatives.
There's some big tropes that movies tend to fall into in terms of like how they're representing Indigenous peoples. A really big trope that sort of looms large within horror is the Native American burial ground trope. The idea of the Indian burial ground trope is when a Native person passes away, like their connection to place is so entangled that they just sort of haunt and curse the earth, right? So that's a very, very common trope. We see that in things like Poltergeist.
It's not ancient tribal burial ground, it's just people.
We see that in things like the Amityville Horror.
There was a tribe of Indians called the Shinnecocks, and they used this land as a sort of exposure pen. They put all the crazy people here, and they left them here to die. There are people buried here.
There's all of those sort of like wacky conspiracy theories about The Shining, because in The Shining there's like that one throwaway line.
The site is supposed to be located on an Indian burial ground, and I believe they actually had to repel a few Indian attacks as they were building it.
And so the anxiety that seems to be structuring, you know, why this is appearing in horror, right, is this sort of guilt around indigenous dispossession, people acknowledging that settler colonialism is wrong, but in some ways still buying into these sort of really troubling primitivist tropes, the idea that native people are disappearing, not because of government policies by settler governments in the United States and Canada and in many other places, right, that are targeting these communities, targeting the abilities for families to function, the abilities for polities to govern. They're saying that there's just like something innate about Native people that is disappearing, that can't cope with modernity, and we're sort of fading into the background, right? I think a really fascinating example of like contemporary Native horror that's sort of thinking about these questions of haunting in a really complicated and nuanced way is the book Shudder by Ramona Emerson, Shudder Like a Camera. It's about this woman named Rita, who's a crime scene investigator, and she has the ability to see ghosts and communicate with ghosts. And so she has to kind of solve these various crimes and mysteries using her ability to communicate with ghosts. But I think some interesting nuanced things that are happening in that book is that, you know, in many indigenous epistemologies, like communication with ancestors and communication with people who are not here in this world anymore isn't actually sort of something scary or unusual. It's like actually usually like a gift. Like people who can do this are seen as being really important people with helpful things that they can contribute to the community. For Rita, her ability to speak with ghosts and see ghosts is actually something that sort of ostracizes her from her community. And so in that way, I think the text is also thinking in complicated ways about sort of like belonging and identity, right? And like, how do people, contemporary indigenous people, like navigate tradition and sort of like the demands of modernity together? There's this other sort of common trope that is really stuck to indigenous representation. It's called a totem transfer. And basically what happens in these texts is that an indigenous character passes on, sometimes in the form of an object, hence totem, more often or equally in the form of like a kind of knowledge transfer. So like Native people have a function, and that function is to just convey knowledge and resources to settler society and then go away.
I'm a warrior. A warrior would rather be defeated and die than act against his nature.
In the case of Poltergeist 2, Will Sampson, you know, passes on this information to the dad character that he needs to solve this conflict.
You should assume full responsibility.
Responsibility for what?
Everything in your world.
And then the Native character kind of disappears, right? Because they've served their purpose. It's fascinating because it's this kind of acknowledgement of, like, there is a use for Indigenous knowledge. The caveat being, right, that Indigenous knowledge is only useful when it's, like, legible within, like, settler knowledge frameworks. And when it's, you know, helpful in reproducing settler structures of oppression, right? If it's challenging, it tends to get chucked. And so it's this kind of platforming and like rewarding of a certain kind of like acquiescence of indigenous peoples, like if you help us, we won't kill you right away, right, is almost what these stories are saying.
And I hope that they'll learn to forget all this soon.
They cannot learn by forgetting.
So another trope that I've encountered in terms of like trends in representing Native people in horror is that there was like a boom of films in the 1970s and 80s that were kind of in some ways like Jaws ripoffs. So everyone kind of wanted to cash in on that. But yeah, these sort of monster attack movies just tend to have tertiary native characters that are in some way kind of, again, super connected to nature, able to sort of interact with non-human animals, but again, in ways that are often kind of degrading, that are coming from a very Western viewpoint that is not thinking about, you know, like the ways that critters do have agency, right? And critters do have knowledge and sentience that I think is conveyed in a lot of traditional stories.
Something that has no fear of man. Something out there waiting for the light to fade.
A really fascinating figure. When I was watching these movies, he was just like this little shining light. There's actually a Nuchelnuth elder, George Clutesy, who appeared in two of these films, Prophecy.
And it will mindlessly, mercilessly kill every living thing it meets. Prophecy.
And Nightwing.
Nightwing.
Let Chief find out what bled your animal to death. Made bite marks no one's ever seen. And left a stink of ammonia.
Both of them came out in 1979. And he's like a very, very fascinating figure because he was a residential school survivor. He was an artist. You know, he's a writer. He wrote children's books. He worked at the residential school as a janitor and taught like traditional language and practices. So in the same year, we have this native actor playing sort of two sides of this representational coin. On one hand, he's sort of like this friendly elder in Prophecy who's helping the main character sort of figure out this mystery, right? Communicate with nature, connect to stories that they might not understand.
I'm teaching these young people so that someone here will remember.
And then in Nightwing, he's definitely like, you know, the monster that will destroy anything at any cost.
You killed our own people.
Yewa will keep the good bath guy out of the underground. The rest will have to die.
Where are the bats?
In the same year, he's sort of playing these two sides of this representational coin. But I think doing so and bringing a presence to these characters that I think is really important work, because we have examples of, you know, Native actors playing these roles that even though they're written in these really sort of racist and problematic ways, I think through their work, right, find ways of expressing something just beyond, right, like what is written into the role. And so I like looking for those types of figures in these texts too. So in terms of like contemporary texts, contemporary Native horror texts that are sort of picking up on this trend, Stephen Graham Jones's The Only Good Indians. It's a sort of retelling of a kind of slasher narrative, but the sort of big monster, the Freddy Krueger, the, you know, Jason Voorhees in that, is this being called Elk Woman. Yes, there is this non-human animal that's the antagonist, but the text is really careful to say that, like, she's not bad just because she's an animal. Human characters and animal characters both sort of transgress. They both take things that they don't necessarily need. And so it shows a kind of like shared consciousness and sentience amongst human and animals that I think is really awesome and is, I think, consciously kind of deconstructing some of these tropes around sort of indigenous peoples and our relationships to nature and to other creatures in the world. What all of this, like, contemporary Native horror is doing is it's, again, it's showing, like, complexity and nuance in Native representation. It's not just good or bad. It's, like, showing all of these shades in between that I think are really important. And you know, traditional stories have always shown, like, nuance and shades in between, right? We have traditional figures that make a mess and do bad stuff. And think about Iktomi stories, right? From the Lakota tradition, like, our trickster figure, Iktomi, like, causes chaos and is deeply helpful in causing chaos, even though he's very annoying, right? That when people make mistakes, they also teach us lessons. And so I think that's something that's going on in all of these texts, that these contemporary Native texts that I talk about is like it's showing a depth to Indigenous existence that I think horror has largely failed to do so. That's what's exciting about all of this new stuff, is that it's like actually thinking about the sort of lack of representation or the problematic representation from these really important critical perspectives, and giving us stories that are not only like scary, gory, freaky stuff, but that it's like truly challenging ideological norms. For me, I think the most important work that this does is that, like, when I teach it, my students learn to read in a new way, and look at the world in a new way that I don't think they would have even been aware of had they not been able to encounter these texts. So,
Dr. Kaylee Simmons is Oglala Lakota. She's a professor of English and social critical inquiry at the University of Connecticut and studies Indigenous representation in horror. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. When I was a wee dear child, my mom would tell us kids to never whistle at night. And while some of us didn't always heed her warning, it did scare the heck out of us. Indigenous storytellers have been scaring the heck out of each other, well, since day has been turning into night. These stories were often shared on winter nights, huddled around a fire or a wood stove. Shane Hawk knows the delights and terrors of Indigenous horror well. He's a Cheyenne and Arapaho horror writer. Last year, he co-edited the best-selling Indigenous dark fiction anthology, fittingly called Never Whistle at Night. Shane, welcome to Unreserved.
Hi, Rosanna. Thank you for having me. So excited to talk to you.
Me too. So obviously, the first question is, why should we never whistle at night, Shane?
Personally, I never grew up with, don't whistle at night story from my grandma or my dad. But I've heard so many different ways. I've heard the warriors in Hawaii, if you whistle at night, they'll come out and start attacking. I've heard snakes will follow you home. Spirits will follow you from the forests. I've heard it from all different angles over the last year.
Yeah. And of course, what my mom would tell me is that the northern lights will come down because they think you want to dance into the sky, and that's what they'll do.
Let's go dancing.
Let's go dancing in the sky. That sounds fun. How did you fall in love with horror fiction?
I wasn't a huge reader as a kid. I was always a movie buff, though. So growing up, I always liked things that were a little creepy, on the creepier side. I grew up with all the horror movies. My dad, even the Blair Witch Project, he got from Blockbuster. But I think he removed the label or something, and he acted like he found the tape at a garage sale. And I think he fast-forwarded past the first bits, so it looked like an actual home movie, so I was terrified. And I thought it was all real.
That's epic.
I know, right? Even my first waking memory when I was 4 years old, my first memory ever that I can recall is Halloween night. My mom and dad went across the street from my grandma's house, and the neighbor was dressed up as a pig. So it was like a pig man, and he was snorting with this like really creepy pig mask. And I can still even visualize it, you know, as a four-year-old. That's my first memory. So ever since, you know, I can remember, I was kind of enticed, intrigued by dark things. Horror fiction really found me through short stories, because big books intimidated me, like those Stephen King tomes, but short stories really caught me off guard, you know, that's just a little bite.
And so what was the moment for you when you took that feeling and the feelings that it gave you and turned it into writing?
It kind of hit me after I read a novella by Stephen Graham Jones called Mapping the Interior. So I read that in the summer of 2019. When I came across this novella, it kind of spoke to me. It felt like, you know, there was two brothers, one had special needs, and that mirrors my existence. My brother has special needs. I know what it feels like to protect him, how it feels when he's in danger or we're in danger. It just kind of directly spoke to me. And then I had this moment where I was like, wow, Stephen is Blackfeet. He's Native American, Indigenous. You know, I'm Cheyenne Arapaho. I'm, you know, Hidatsa, Citizen Potawatomi. Maybe I could try this. I like spooky stuff. Ever since I could remember, I loved putting masks on and scaring people from around the corner. And I just get a thrill out of that, kind of that prank part of it, where you just want to scare someone, and it kind of leads to laughter, because I think comedy and horror are just like part of the same coin, just, you know, one's heads, one's tails. And I also love dark humor, and I think it's a good marriage between the two. You know, in a lot of my horror fiction, I like to scare people as much as I like to make them giggle or laugh. And I think it was after reading that novella and just noticing, man, this guy's amazing. And he's a native writer. He's indigenous. It blew me away because it was short form. It wasn't a short story. It was beyond, you know, a novelette or like a long short story. But it wasn't that thick, intimidating novel. And I said, what if I could write a novella or something in the short form and express myself, express my indigeneity, and creep people out and have a good time with it?
You know, watching horror movies is different than actually writing horror. What does writing horror allow you to express or face?
I think consuming horror media, so, you know, TV shows, films, things like that, you're seeing that someone else's vision. You're seeing how they're expressing themselves, and maybe you're trying to connect to it. But when you're writing, you're in that driver's seat, you get to choose what happens to whom. And that makes it all the more exciting, because you're in like this literal creator mode. They're going to go and do this, and this terrible thing is going to happen, and therefore this happens. You get to create this kind of long list of conflicts and things that people have to deal with. And some of my writings can be cathartic, be therapeutic. Like for me, actually delving into the writing and getting my thoughts onto the page, it's therapeutic. It's a nice release. I let go of that piece of myself, maybe not forever, maybe temporarily. I get to express my experiences and hope that maybe I'm not alone in this world. Maybe other indigenous people can relate with my experiences. I have a dark past of dealing with depression. I'm really open with these things. And I get to, when I'm on the page, kind of deal with that old self and let go of it. That's what I did with my first collection called Anoka. I based it, yes, in a city called Anoka in Minnesota. And I basically wrote these six short stories to kind of let go of a lot of mixtures of trauma, of things that I've dealt with, identity issues. And it's therapeutic even going back to those stories and reading them and seeing like, oh, this is how dark I was feeling at that time, or, oh, this is myself in my early 20s, and now it's forever on a page. And if I ever feel that way again, it's like a good reminder of, hey, this is where I am now. I have a daughter, I'm married, we have a house, things are good, I'm still here. You know, I'm not afraid to speak on those past issues I've had, especially as a high school teacher. I like to kind of, you know, highlight these things because a lot of teens need this kind of guidance too.
Yeah.
Whether they're into horror fiction or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. You know, and as you're working out these, you know, these experiences and sharing and those perspectives and catharsis, as you say, who are the monsters in your work? Who are the people that are coming at you, as it were, out of the darkness?
Man, it's a number of things. Sometimes literally a creature, but, you know, a lot of times the creatures can serve as metaphors for other things, right? So it can be colonialism in ways that sometimes we're helpless to deal with, things like governmental decisions paired with corporations that do what they want to do and take over certain lands and not give them back, pipelines. It can go that way. It can go the way of abusive people in my past that dealt with alcoholism. Can be confronting the depression. I literally had kind of a character at a time, not kind of a main stage character, but kind of a background character of literally depression taking form of kind of like a black cloud. Because that's one experience I've had in my past, is when I was in such dark days, you know, I wasn't asleep, it wasn't a dream. I saw in the corner of my room a dark cloud that was floating above my TV, and it was kind of reaching out to me. And so I kind of put these experiences down onto paper. And yeah, I mean, there's so many things that, so many monsters that I could try to create. I haven't still had a ton of time to even get all the monsters down on the page yet. There's still a lot more to write down, but that's what I've got so far.
Lots of darkness to explore.
Yeah.
As Indigenous people, you know, stories and storytelling is a really important part of our way of life and, you know, our ways of being. Why do you think that is? Why are Indigenous people, you know, drawn to scary stories in particular?
I'm trying not to be monolithic, right, ever. But I think a lot of us, our parents, our grandparents, great-grandparents, etc., our ancestors, have dealt with so much real-life horrors. Once again, you're in a safe space when you hear a story, right? You're not literally experiencing the story. You're hearing it, right? You're hearing it from someone else. They're sharing it through the spoken word. And you get to maybe find a release in yourself of hearing this creepy tale, but knowing that maybe it won't happen to you. Wow, this person dealt with this. This creature went after these people. You know, a lot of Indigenous spooky stories deal with revenge, which is cathartic. Or, you know, ways in which people get their comeuppance. And so I think in a lot of ways, a lot of Indigenous folks like to hear creepy stories. I think also because it's a way to connect. You know, just like when you go to a comedy show with a friend, you want to laugh together. You want to connect. Mm-hmm. And with spooky stories, you know, a lot of times I've been with Native friends around a table and you're just trying to creep each other out. It's like a contest. It's a way to, you know, rib each other. It's trying to get a rise out of people. Just the same way you're trying to out-joke each other, you also, in a way, try to out-creep each other out. And I think a lot of us connect with it because it's that kind of flip side of the coin of comedy, where I think comedy and horror kind of can make people connect just in different ways. And I think that's one of the main reasons why Indigenous people are kind of more apt to be connected to spooky stories.
You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. My guest today is horror writer Shane Hawk. Shane recently captured a bunch of his favorite spooky storytellers. Not in a dungeon or anything like that, but in an anthology called Never Whistle at Night. He says there's something about our shared history as Indigenous people that lends itself to scary stories. And maybe something supernatural binds us together as well.
A lot of us are connected to our lands and the waters and our ancestors, our teachings, that I think we experience slightly more things out in the actual world. We notice things. We hear the birds talking a certain way. We can hear the trees and the wind a certain way. And I think we witness a lot more. We take in a lot more than, say, non-Native folks. I'm not sure about you, but I know a lot of family members, a lot of friends, they've had a lot of supernatural experiences. So I think there's also that level. Like, hey, these might be stories, these might be real. You know, they might be 50-50 or 75-25. And so I think it's also that. You know, I think we might be, you know, slightly more connected in some ways. Maybe not all of us, but a good chunk of us probably. Because I've heard so many dang stories of things that people have witnessed at night, people have come across, people had to outrun, people had to shoot at. There's been a lot of things. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard many of those stories myself. And as we mentioned last year, you co-edited and released Never Whistle at Night. And as you were gathering these stories, you mentioned some of them just now, from, you know, so many Indigenous writers all over Turtle Island. What kinds of, you know, stories were they telling? What kinds of monsters and villains were coming out of the darkness in that anthology?
There are human monsters, right? Man-made monsters. There are colonialism itself. They're like, say, off the top of my head, Nick Medina's story, Quantum. tackles the idea, the concept of blood quantum and how it can damage a family. And that is a colonial idea that a lot of people are aware of. And maybe a lot of non-natives that come across our anthology have no idea about. I've seen a lot of reviews actually talk about that story. And I think a lot of people don't know about BQ. And they'll read that story and be disgusted and say, how could that mom treat that baby that way? But that colonial mindset, I think, affects families, tears each other down. And then we have infighting. And then we actually become monsters because we are letting colonialism dictate how we feel about each other and how we judge each other. Before I started talking to you, I came across a review that said, maybe these people that wrote Never Will Slide Night aren't Native because they're not all enrolled members of their nations. Being a descendant is not enough. So the monsters take many forms in Never Will Slide Night. I want people to understand that it's not just all literal creatures. And then a lot of it's also real life horror of dealing with racism, colorism, like I said, blood quantum, of kind of like all these microaggression and like real aggressions, like actual being attacked and things that a lot of indigenous people experience day to day. And I think a lot of readers are connecting with it, both who are indigenous and then also non-indigenous people are maybe taking steps back and realizing, wow, there are horrors in this life that I don't experience, that these people are experiencing or their families are. And maybe there's more horror in the world than I thought.
You had mentioned some of the monsters in real life, quote unquote, that are mentioned in the anthology, like Pretendian Hunters, Descendian, this idea that it's not enough. How does horror writing lend itself to being able to face these truths and talk about them in this way?
So I think with horror fiction, it's a pretty decent vehicle to explore these things, to confront them, in that with horror fiction, you literally are fighting something almost all the time, whether it's a monster, a situation you have to get yourself out of that is not good. And in horror, you know, a lot of times it's over the top, it's exaggerated. It's, you know, there's blood and guts, there's viscera, there's all these things. But we can't do that in real life unless we want to get sent to prison, right?
Yeah.
We can't confront our bosses or the racist person down the street or people that have actually abused us without repercussions, right? So with horror fiction, I think tackling even huge ideas as colonialism, although they are filtered down to maybe a replica within a monster, it allows us to kind of cathartically address these issues by literally the protagonist stabbing it to death, or maybe even there's dialogue between characters of how to deal with something, and then it gets the reader thinking, like, you know, maybe it isn't right that the government's doing this. You know, it gets the readership kind of interested in these issues. When you're reading these terrible stories, you know, terrible as in, horrific, you know, the person with the knife, the person with the machete, they kind of have the power at the time, and they can turn on a dime, they can have a monologue about a certain issue that's afflicting their community. They can literally, within the narrative, pretty much paint a picture of how an issue has affected their community. And maybe, depending on how crazy the narrative goes, those people can get revenge. Mm. Or those people can literally attack a monster that is modeled after blood quantum. Or something that is, you know, harming children. Those evil perpetrators that are stealing and murdering indigenous people. I think because the basis of horror is very emotion-based, right? I think off the top of my head, the only other genre that's pretty much 100% emotion-based just in the word is romance. And I think when you have horror, you know, it's meant to elicit shock, it's meant to gross you out. But I think the newer emerging writers that are attacking this genre are using it to kind of address issues, social injustices, things that a lot of writers haven't tackled before. And I think partly another thing with that is the horror writing community itself is becoming much more diverse than it was 10 years ago. And I think, you know, not to disparage any, you know, white writers, but white writers aren't confronting certain things because they probably don't experience certain things, right? Maybe they don't experience blood quantum, right? Maybe they don't get attacked by their landlord because, you know, they're having ceremony. I think now that we have a much diverse kind of section within the horror community, it's growing every day. A lot more people are getting published, people of color, people of tribal nations. I think we're going to see a lot more horror narratives, whether they're novels, novellas, novelettes, short stories, confronting things that kind of have been swept under the rug for centuries of literature. You know, a lot of us don't feel like it's our job to educate, you know, non-Indigenous people about every single thing. Like, hey, maybe go Google some stuff. You know, maybe we don't have to be teachers every single day of our lives. But I think through fiction, especially horror fiction, you can kind of covertly educate, whether it's a conversation between characters that's even facetious, that's being kind of funny. And, you know, maybe it stays with people if they laugh at it or if they get scared from it. I think that kind of jogs the memory a little bit and it kind of, they retain it more.
Mm. And as we see, you know, more and more Indigenous storytellers telling these spooky, scary stories, where do you think it will go to? Are we going to see, you know, Stephen King movies now? Are we going to see more mainstream sort of treatments of our spooky stories?
I'd hope so. Hollywood's a weird animal to tackle. It's untamable. Mm. And we're trying to maybe talk about Never Whistle at Night as, you know, a movie property or a TV property where we can have a native writing room, Indigenous people being in control of their narratives and kind of taking it back from non-Indigenous people that have written caricatures of us, have made us into this monolith, this pan-Indian kind of. I think it's going to get better, better and better. It's going to always improve. Hollywood has to eventually give in, I think. I see, yes, kind of Stephen King level adaptations. I think Hollywood is just slow to adapt. Mm-hmm. I think the literature industry, you know, the book industry is really catching on with a lot of Indigenous storytelling. They're seeing that, you know, maybe hopefully it's, you know, it's beyond the profit motive for them. Hopefully they're actually enticed by our stories that connect with people. And they actually, as good people, want to push these stories out and help us reach audiences and get our voices heard. Hopefully it's beyond the profit motive, but I know that's definitely part of it. But there's quite a few people that are, you know, in the game, making movies, making horror films. I even just got asked by someone to watch their screener, their Indigenous horror film, so that I can give them a quote for their poster. And so, you know, this stuff is happening right now. It's just kind of slowly moving. Even for other movies, Hollywood moves at the, like, molasses in the winter. It's very slow. You know, you'll get an email, hey, you know, write the script, and then you won't hear from them for a year. But eventually it'll get there, I think. You know, hopefully we get maybe kind of Indigenous Goosebumps or Indigenous American Horror Story. Like, think about how amazing that could be. Whether it's us, you know, doing Never Whistle at Night in some TV form, or it's someone else who's Indigenous that's getting it done. We just want to see it happen.
Mm-hmm. Native American Horror Story. Can you just imagine?
Yes. I'm ready.
Shane, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks so much. I love the questions. Love talking about horror, Indigenous horror specifically. I loved all of it. Thanks so much.
And happy Halloween.
You too.
And remember, don't whistle at night.
Yes, never whistle at night.
Shane Hawk is a Cheyenne and Arapaho horror writer and the co-editor of Never Whistle at Night. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Halloween is a favorite time of year for Inuit sisters Tiffany Eilik and Inukshuk Mackay. Pilk Silk are throat singers who bring a contemporary sound to the ancient tradition. A couple of years ago, the self-described Fairy Goth Mothers released this song along with the Halloween Well Wishes. Ikita means light it, and the sisters offered it as a few flickers of light in a time of sublime darkness. This is Ikita. That is Pilk Silk with Ikita. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. One of my favorite horrifying poets is Edgar Allan Poe, or Eep, as I like to call him. If you, too, are a fan of his macabre poetry and prose, meet Tiffany Morris.
Hecatomb. This horizon of rusted machines extracts what shines bright. Golden poisons, black snakes, and femurs glistening. Flowers drip like meat, wrap our bleaching bones, a shrine to what devours us. What breathes in stillness? On the edge of the green dark, nothing breathes in full. The dried riverbed teems with hard rot. God is not in this new desert.
That is Tiffany Morris reading her poem, Hecatomb. She's the author of the horror poetry collection, Elegies of Rotting Stars, and the spooky swamp core novella, Green Fuse Burning. Tiffany's writing doesn't shy away from the issues haunting her in real life, like our future as we live through a climate crisis. Tiffany, welcome to Unreserved.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for having me.
So we just heard you read from one of your poems, Hecatomb. Can you tell me what was on your mind as you were writing that poem?
Yeah, a lot of my writing, especially in the poetry space, tends to help me work through different things that are on my mind. So in this case, I was really thinking about climate crisis and extractive industries and what the changes in landscape that I'm experiencing. So increased humidity in the summertime is kind of influencing that sense of breathing and suffocation, and just thinking about those changing landscapes that become fallow, that become deserts where they were not before. And I was just kind of working through my own feelings of doom about it.
And when you think about our future, you know, with these sort of changes brought on by climate change, what kind of future are you picturing?
It depends on the day. Yeah. On optimistic days, I really believe in resurgence and resilience and Indigenous ways of knowing epistemologies, traditional knowledges leading the way forward through climate crisis. If we don't end up going that route, you know, kind of globally, it's a much more kind of doom-laden picture for me. I do hope at my core that humans will come to new relationships with land and consider it in new ways as it changes, because we kind of really don't have any other choice at the moment.
As a horror writer, I imagine that it's most of the time it is not a very good picture that you have in your mind.
Yeah, it's kind of writing about what I'm seeing, so not necessarily what I'm envisioning for the future, although in Green Fuse Burning, I kind of take a near future perspective on it. Yeah, it's kind of working through what I see and kind of what happens if I catastrophize the catastrophe even further.
Mm. How did you decide that horror writing was the right outlet for your climate anxiety and all these things that you're observing and feeling?
Yeah, it just kind of came to me. I mean, I do have a few pieces that are much more optimistic that are working in utopian futurism, and that tends to be the sci-fi space for me. When I write things that are horror-oriented, it's definitely that working through climate anxiety. And it was never my intention to do that. It was just when I was thinking about what seemed urgent to me, because horror is a space that deals with urgency and the inability to refuse what's in front of you. It deals with that kind of revelation. It seemed like a natural fit for, you know, uncovering what is often denied and interrogating the urgent things that are in front of you.
Tiffany, what exactly is a horror poem?
That's a really interesting question, because I'm not sure that there's one singular definition of what makes a horror poem a horror poem. Some would say some of the romantic writers back in the day, they were working in the horror space. Of course, Edgar Allan Poe, you know, contemporary horror poets have these kind of predecessors. I would say horror poetry is anything that is articulating some of the gaps in genre and poetry to tell stories that would otherwise be told in fiction in poetry, and really utilizing what makes poetry unique to tell it.
How does it feel to express these feelings in those visceral poems or a scary story?
Good and bad. Mm-hmm. it depends. There's a lot of self-care involved, especially if you're treading very rich psychological territory, you know, getting into those kind of details with a character. I would watch a lot of kind of happy TV afterward if I was going through a particularly difficult chapter or poem. But I think that it's helpful to just kind of bring that out to the surface. There's a catharsis in it.
What was the first, like, horror story or poem that you read that really spoke to you and sort of gave you the idea that you wanted to express your own feelings in this way?
It's kind of always been part of what I've enjoyed, horror media. I remember being very young and reading kind of horror stories for kids. And then I kept coming closer and closer to genre, and it kept doing more for me. I really, really love Shirley Jackson's work. I think she plays with anxiety in really interesting ways, especially in that kind of domestic space. I also love kind of more abstract writers like Leonora Carrington, who, yeah, just kind of bring that kind of experimental, hyper-stylized stuff to the surface as well.
Mm-hmm. Are there other Indigenous writers in your genre that you particularly are inspired from when you write or...
Yeah,
explore?
Louise Erdrich, of course, is a huge influence on Indigenous writing in general. Stephen Graham Jones is a huge force in Indigenous horror. He's probably the best known of all of us. I think I owe a debt of gratitude to basically every Indigenous writer who's come before me.
Yeah. Is there hope in horror, Tiffany?
I think there's hope in horror. It's kind of a hotly contested question, and I love that it's itself unresolved because horror deals so much with the unresolved. I think that hope is a beautiful and tenuous thing, and it's really up to the writer and reader how they understand that to exist in a space where you're contending with all of these issues.
Yeah. And quite honestly, it's a place where we can be bleak and, you know, and that's okay because it's supposed to be scary.
Yeah, it's a fantastic outlet.
If your readers are feeling just as scared, you know, about climate change, for example, as you are, what do you hope that they take away from, you know, reading your poems and stories?
I really hope that people feel seen by what I've written, whether it's a shared experience or just thematic resonance or just an appreciation of how I've put together a story. I hope that every reader takes something from it.
Well, Tiffany, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Will Allen.
Tiffany Morris is a Mi'kmaq horror writer and poet from Halifax. Tiffany shared a few of her favorite Indigenous writers, Shirley Jackson, Lenora Carrington, Louise Erdrich, and Stephen Graham Jones. Here's Shane Hawk again with a few of his recommendations.
So, The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones is a must, along with pretty much all of his stuff. It pushed me to want to be a better writer. It pushed me in all different ways. It excited me. It scared me. It amazed me. Indigenous horror, let's think of films. I think I'd be remiss if I don't mention Jeff Barnaby's Blood Quantum.
Who says we're immune? A duck jaw looks at humble.
Rest in peace, journey on, well, brother, but we're gonna miss him a lot. I was really looking forward to his vision to making more Indigenous horror films, but he passed away. But Blood Quantum, an amazing film. Let's see, alongside with that, if you haven't seen Clear Cut with Graham Greene, you gotta see that one.
We have to purify ourselves for what's coming next.
Graham Greene, he's basically a lessons teacher for his people, and he's dealing with this logging company, and they want to clear out a whole bunch of land, basically to, that's on a res. And so Graham Greene, his name is Arthur, he's basically trying to get these logging men out of there. He doesn't want there to be any further abuse. And so it's totally horrific Indigenous horror revenge film. And he's badass, he is everything you could want. So that's my top three, one book and two films.
Shane Hawk is a Cheyenne and Arapaho horror author and the co-editor of Never Whistle at Night. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Elena Haunted Hudgens Lyle, Kim the Slasher Casher, Rhiannon Jigsaw Johnson, and Bridget Stringham Up Stringer Holden. You can now listen to us streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. And you can find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite goblin, Rosanna the Darkness Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Naskinamit Nawa. I go say.